So how do you market an entire state? How about some advice every PR professional should follow? And how many burpees are too many burpees? Let's find out. Today, we talk with Emily Garant, a great friend and the Vice President of Marketing, Communications, and Public Relations for the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. It's time for some cold oatmeal.
Welcome to Cold Oatmeal, a podcast by the Rush Strategies team about PR and public affairs. Really.
I was distracted staring at Joe's cold oatmeal.
Yeah, well, it's here.
He's got it on his
desk. It's always here. It's always here.
And by the way, the ratio of like fruit to disgusting, like 1 to 10, it's got some disgusting stuff in some fruit.
There's nothing disgusting.
One part
What in there is disgusting?
I don't even know what's in it, but it looks like cucumber mash. Maybe a couple of chopped apples.
Did you have Burger King for Christmas?
Don't say that!
Okay, we are back with our first episode of Cold Oatmeal. We have put the pilot into the pilot episode into the archives for people to look into, but this is officially episode number one. We've already been evicted from our studios because of construction in the building, but we are nothing if not versatile. And we're gonna roll with it. And here we are for our first official episode. I'm joined. I'll look around the table and let everyone introduce themselves. Joe.
Joe Besci, podcast roadie.
Nick DeLu, happy to sit in. Thanks for.
Yes, Nick is joining us this week.
Yes, and Sarah Amre, your in-house social media person.
Excellent, thank you. And our guest, Emily Garant. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, it's great. You know, our Zach Gorchow was our great first pilot guest, but I always think back to that first, you know, the pilot episode of Seinfeld that doesn't look like anything like the rest
Didn't
of the episodes.
Did they discuss the buttons in that one?
That was the button
That
episode,
was the button
and
episode.
And it was kind of terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the callback in the finale, but yeah.
So that can Zach can be our forgotten
He's
pilot.
The first button.
Yes, he is the first button. So.
The other weird thing about the first episode, and then we can go into it, George is actually kind of, like, cool.
Yeah.
He's like, normal.
I wonder if that didn't test well.
No, they must have did the feedback, and, like, the 12 people they asked for feedback said, George can't be cool.
He can't be cool. He doesn't look cool. He kind of looks like a curmudgeon, right?
Yeah, he was giving Jerry, like, girl advice, and it just didn't work. Yeah. It was weird.
We should add that to the list of things we talk about. So, we did come up with some new questions for you, okay. But I am going to start with one that we kind of asked Zach, and that is, you know, when you go up to Central for homecoming, mm-hmm. How do you describe your job?
Well, I've been going back to homecoming and to speak to classes for a long time, so how I've described my jobs over time has evolved. And what I describe right now, first of all, is my dream job because I love the state of Michigan and I love being in a position that gets to promote and market and tell good stories about it. What we do at the MEDC and what I get to touch is a wide spectrum, though, of communications. We get to do public relations and digital communications and marketing and advertising. So a pretty wide gamut of tools. And I don't have to be an expert in any one of those, but I get to kind of manage and facilitate all of them.
Cool. Now, we're going to take, I know that you said this is your dream job for mm-hmm. the state of Michigan, but a slight tangent. You've traveled quite a bit. You got to travel with the governor to
yes.
China a couple of times.
Yes.
You've traveled with your family, I know.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a place in the world you could do this same job, if you could be the marketing person for any place in the world, where would that be?
And I can't say Michigan?
You can't. We'll just assume that Michigan is your top choice. But if you could pick a place someplace else in the world, that you wanted to do the same kind of work, the same job, and I guess why?
Well, I guess I would have different answers on different days. I mean, one of the most exciting things I'm working on right now is the new mobility industry, and the brand that we have launched, Planet M, that is trying to position Michigan as a leader in mobility. And when I get involved in that and I love it so much, I do think, oh, I wonder what it would like to do this job in Silicon Valley. I wonder what it would be like to do this job in another area, you know, China, Tokyo, other areas are very aggressive. If I think about the tourism side of how we get to promote, is there another state or community that would be great to promote just for tourism? So I guess it depends on how I wake up that morning.
Do you ever get a chance to talk to your colleagues who do this in other states?
I get
a sense of what they say, you know, Silicon Valley folks or people in other countries even who do this work for other entities?
I get to chat with some of my peers at other states from an economic development standpoint. In fact, I have a conference I'm going to in October that's out in Denver that is the equivalent of me at other states, or maybe for a large metro region like Columbus or Austin, Texas. And I get a chance to talk to them. Once in a while on the international trips, I get a chance to meet people who are doing something similar, but maybe for their whole country, like someone from China or all of Japan who is in charge of marketing.
Well, give us a sense on what your daily job is like. How do you approach the idea of marketing an entire state? A state is a very diverse place, especially Michigan. Our industries are very diverse. Our tourism is diverse. Our people are diverse. Mm-hmm. How do you approach marketing an entity like that?
Well, we try to break it down into target industries. And I'm big on using research in all of communications. I like having research to try to streamline or focus in either on a message or an audience that I think is most relevant, or in this case, maybe the best who you can sway. It doesn't do us any good to go after a company that wouldn't match up with Michigan's industry base, our logistics, our talent base, is so ingrained in a community, we're never going to get them to come here anyway. So I don't want to go after those types of folks. So working with our research team and our business development team, at least right now, we have core industries that we think Michigan is best positioned to expand in, mobility being one of them, the auto industry, and auto meaning manufacturing or the R&D side. Michigan has, we own 75% of all auto R&D happening in the world right now, but we'd love to grow that to 80 or 90%. I mean, there's still so much growth there. Agribusiness is another industry that we go after. Cybersecurity, which is a new and emerging industry. It kind of fits well in with IT, which Michigan was already strong at. So it is hard to think about how you market a whole state. That's the way we approach it. We kind of break it down into segments or industries that are a little bit more tangible and then allow us to create a story around it and allow us to think of a way that you can position Michigan within it.
Now, is your team divided up along those industries, or does your team handle all things, or are there people who focus just on the agribusiness side and just on the automotive side?
Well, we work very closely with other parts of state government. So in agribusiness, we work very closely with the folks over at MDARD, and they are kind of the industry experts. They help us understand a lot about the businesses we want to go after. But then the marketing part of it is coming out of MEDC. So we do have an internal staff, and we're organized into actually like three sections, one being a PR and digital section, two being a marketing section, and three being like events and sponsorships, and also the protocol trips, the international trips that the governor takes. So that's how we're organized. And we use two agencies. We use a public relations agency, and we use an advertising agency that we really need to amplify the message on a national, international scale. The capabilities of the staff we have are only going to go so far, and these audiences are just larger and more expansive to get to.
I want to get into that agency issue a little bit here, because obviously that's something that's close to our heart. But I did, you and I have known each other and worked together for 15, 16 years.
We're babies.
Yes, our first jobs together in the legislature. You left the legislature to establish a public affairs firm here in Lansing, a very successful one, which is now the Lambert Edwards folks in their office here in town. And then you came to MEDC. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, is there a PR constant, some approach or truth that you found doing work for a public official, work for a PR agency, and now work for the state and MEDC that you found across the board, this is a constant that is true no matter what?
Yes, I think it has gone under different terms depending on what the buzzwords are, and I don't know if these are on Nick's list or not, so I apologize up front if I'm going to say a banned or soon-to-be banned word.
The list is always growing.
Yeah, okay. It's a fluid list.
Yeah. I would, at some points, I think it's authenticity, it's transparency, which is a bad buzzword, and what they say now, just the storytelling side of it. And all of it to me was the same, though. It just has looked different depending on where I worked or the time, too, before social media, after social media.
Is there a big difference that you found? Obviously, technology is incredibly different. Mm-hmm. I remember when you and I got started, it was a fax machine, We didn't even email press releases to people. We faxed them.
We still went down into the basement and would put them in the box.
Yep, and we would go up to Tim Skubick's box, and there would be 1,700 press releases falling out of it because he never collected them. So what about a big difference that you've seen in those years?
Certainly how we communicate with reporters because of technology, how they are spreading their news because of technology. Just dealing with reporters, I mean, the news industry has changed dramatically over the 20 years of my professional career, and the resources that they've had at their disposal or the way they do their jobs, and I guess the shrinking of the news industry and the quality of the reporters too, or how long they're reporters before they feel that they need to move on to something else in their life. And those things have changed.
Talk about the reporters, because you now have a very niche, you know, you have people who cover the economic development and the business beat. Mm-hmm. A little differently than when we were in the Capitol, and you had, you know, you obviously had Capitol reporters, but they were covering many, many issues. Sometimes they would come into business and economic development. But talk a little bit about the difference in dealing with reporters who have a specific beat and are become real experts in the issue, and reporters who maybe have 50 issues that they have to cover on a given day and may need a little more background and information.
Absolutely. We are not, I mean, we are part of state government. We're quasi, DC is. But I think there are reporters out there who don't think of us in the political way. They don't cover us as like, well, you know, I'm a business reporter and what you guys, you're more of a political entity or vice versa. I'm a political reporter and you guys are really a business group. So sometimes we have a struggle getting reporters to understand why they should be covering us and what we're doing. And how we should be treated. I think the good business writers out there have shrunk dramatically too, and not the people themselves, just the outlets and the dedication that they're giving to having maybe a business columnist plus a couple business reporters. Now you might just be lucky to have one good business person at an outlet, and they have to kind of do both, and they have to cover more than they were covering before. So we, like a lot of people, have had to adjust and make some stories as localized as we can to get an outlet to want to pick it up. And in other cases, we have to link Michigan into a national trend or some sort of trend so that they want to cover it with more of a national view. And all of our national outreach is always about positioning Michigan in the best way. And so those national trends attempts become more important.
And I think, too, it's sort of become a little more difficult with the regionalization and with the shrinking group of reporters that you've got. I mean, when you got started, Matt, when you got started, when I got started, relationships, they're still so important. You'd have relationships with people that have been on the job for 10, 15, 20 years, and you've still got that with some folks, but so many of them have retired now, and the turnover's so quick, and the newsrooms are shrinking so much. It seems to be a challenge to foster those relationships, mm-hmm. especially when you're dealing with something where it's sort of a niche field, or you've got to convince somebody one way or another.
Absolutely. Covering state government's not easy. I mean, for the new reporters that come into downtown Lansing or go to maybe one of the Detroit papers but have to cover Lansing, it's so big, and there's so many different stories. When, you know, what did Zach say? He gets, you know, 200
emails
a day or most of it people pitching him stories. That would be so difficult to have to weed through and figure out what's important, what's not important to you, to your readers, what they want to know.
And you're
one of them.
You're one of 17, 18. I mean, you're not a department official. You're a public-private organization. But again, you're one of those mm-hmm. one of those organizations competing for their very limited attention.
Right. They don't. One of the things I thought was interesting that Zach had said, and I think we try to preach internally when we bring on a new intern or we bring on a young employee, is kind of the, well, it's know your audience, but know your reporter audience too. Mm-hmm. Like, what is Gong we're really going to care about? They probably don't care about this job announcement in Traverse City that we're making. We don't even need to send that to them. But they are going to come cover our once a month strategic fund board. It's a government appointed body. It's a little bit more of that government function. And they're going to care about, you know, a new CEO, and they would care about maybe, you know, trends within the economy, like finding a way to link it to that reporter. So it really does force the PR person or the team to not just mass distribute things, but to really take the time to think, okay, what will this outlet care about or this reporter, and how can I make it relevant to them?
Have you found it more challenging or easier? I don't want to use the word easy because it's never easy, but easier to get coverage from MEDC versus a PR firm? Like when you had many clients you were working with and you were trying to get coverage placed, it's always challenging to get mm-hmm. people's attention. Do you find it easier one in one position or the other?
I hate saying it, but yes, it's easier at MEDC than it was when I was at the agency. And maybe because I loved my clients that I had when I was at Lambert Edwards and John Bailey. Some of them were smaller, though. It was just hard to be competitive with bigger topics, or maybe their issue wasn't as relevant in the political spectrum, given the layout in the legislature or the governor at the time. We have the advantage at MEDC that often we're making an announcement with the governor or with high-ranking, the mayor of Detroit, you know, a name that goes along with it, then where the media just will pay attention.
Well, this goes into the next question I wanted to ask you about, because I'd like to compare, I would like to, like, tap into your current knowledge and brain and go back in time to when you were starting. It was John Bailey at first, yes. And then became Lambert Edwards. You know, you started a firm basically from scratch, a public affairs firm in Lansing. You were focused on finding clients, cultivating clients, and attracting work. You now are the client.
Yeah.
You mentioned in the beginning that you have agencies that work for you. What do you wish you knew then about serving clients that you know now as a client?
That's a good question. I often think about it more in the reverse, in that I think I'm a great client because I understand how it is to be at an agency.
Everybody's
a great
client.
True. We all think we're great clients. I feel like I put more effort into talking to the agency. Are we being a good client right now? What are we doing wrong? I mean, we give them plenty of feedback, obviously, all the time. It's important to ask for it on the flip side. I think you can never have a successful team there if the client doesn't know how to utilize the agency well, too. And that was something I didn't know when I was starting an agency, was the client side. I'm a people person. I like relationships, and I didn't know how that would translate into, one, getting business, and two, you know, the client management side of it. But always being able to help the client understand, how can I be best utilized by you? Because at least I thought, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but sometimes the client comes and they really don't know what they want, or they think they have an idea of what they want, and once you really talk to them about it, you're like, well, my opinion would be, no, you don't need that. You need something else.
Is there some advice you would pass on to those of us on the other side? You know, as a high profile client at MEDC, what would you say all PR firms should know? What should everyone remember?
Well, again, I don't think it'll be a successful partnership if you're not really one team. And to be one team, you have to get to know your client really well. I think maybe some of our biggest frustrations with any agency that you work with is you feel like they don't get you enough, or they don't understand your issues enough, and that you spend just as much time having to, you know, bring them up to speed or educate them on a topic as you would wanting them out there promoting that topic.
Okay. So we're going to shift gears a little bit here as we wrap up, and this is not a visual medium, obviously. We're on a podcast, so if this was a TV thing, I'd ask you to hold up your hands to show all the bloody callus you always have from all of the working out that you do at the CrossFit. So as we wrap up, we talked about this before you got here, and had a little bit of a bet as to how many we could all do. But how many, if we put on the clock for 5 minutes, you wouldn't need to wear what you're wearing now. You're obviously very professionally dressed and not really dressed appropriately for this challenge. But in 5 minutes, how many burpees could you do?
How many could I do?
How many? If we just set the clock for 5 minutes and said go, what would it be?
Well, last time that I had to do 100 burpees, it took me 8.5 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think I could get to 50.
Did you have to take breaks, sure, or did you just pace yourself?
You can do all the way my gym worked. You know, they didn't care how you did it. I did try to do them in sets of 10, and I would do 10, and then I would, you know, break for 15, 20 seconds and then do sets of 10. I tried to do something that was, a pace was attainable. I actually did 20 as my first set because I'm very mental with these things, and I feel like that's like getting a head start if I did 20 instead of 10, but that was bad because I was really tired at the end of 20 and I needed a longer break to recover. I mean, there were people in my class who got done a lot faster than that. I just, we had a 10-minute cap, so no matter what, I was going to be done at 10 minutes. And if I was just dying and dragging, there was a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, I can confidently say that I've done 100 in the last 2 years.
Oh! Nick, so you could handle 108 minutes, right?
I can handle 100 in the next week. No
there
problem.
You go. Break
no
it
sweat.
Down. Yep. You've got to break everything down into what's manageable.
Well, I was telling them, I don't know that I've ever done a burpee. I've done push-ups.
I've jumped. I bet in school you had a gym teacher, a physical education teacher who made you do a burpee.
You know, I was a band kid, so I didn't even have to take phys ed.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
Really?
Yeah, right.
What
I got
kind
out.
Of school is that?
Phys ed was an elective in the Grand Rapids Public Schools.
Oh, this explains a lot.
Yeah, I know.
Get me on my childhood obesity topic again. And
well, I didn't have a problem with that either.
So. Nick has the fastest metabolism of anyone I've ever seen.
So. Yeah. Yes, it's true.
Okay, well, on that note, again, metabolism, we'll wrap up on that. We appreciate you stopping by and sharing your knowledge and expertise.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Grant from MEDC.
Story about faxing, because I had a job where I was an intern and I had no clue how to fax, and I didn't know we like had to send out, we had received them and then I had to send them back, and I had no clue and I was nervous to ask because I didn't want to be like, oh, who doesn't know how to fax, like it's a general office task. But I had no clue what I was doing, and then one day like we hadn't gotten any faxes for like 2 weeks, and I realized that I hadn't refilled the paper.
Oh, nice.
There had to have been like a little alert, but I didn't know what it meant or something. And so then I put paper in there, and then we got like 75 faxes all at once. And
so talk about bringing something full circle. That goes back to Seinfeld, because there's a Seinfeld episode about everything. And as we talked to Emily about being in China, there's the great episode with the Japanese tourists. And
they love oranges.
Right, they love oranges. And Kramer's got them, you know, shoved into dresser drawers to sleep, right, because he spent all their money on nightclubs and such. But the other thread in that episode is Elaine's got a boyfriend who thinks that Jerry is poor. And so he buys him an umbrella because he sees him out in the rain without an umbrella. And the reason he thinks he's poor is because the comment comes up when he's being introduced to him. The comment comes up that, you know, Jerry doesn't yet have a fax machine. And they sort of, oh, well, things will pick up for you, Jerry. Things will pick up for you. And, you know, Tom Gantard, I think, has commented, a lot of folks know Tom, former at the Ann Arbor News, and now he's at the Mackinac and Capital Confidential. He's commented so many times on social media that Seinfeld couldn't exist today because of the technology. Like a smartphone would ruin almost every episode of Seinfeld and take away all the gags.
I don't know. I mean, no, because
I'm probably slightly misquoting him, but.
Well, they have a whole Twitter feed about the modern day
Seinfeld.
Yeah, I was
gonna
say, it could be restructured.
It worked. Curb Your Enthusiasm is Seinfeld today, and they're still doing that, and it worked. I mean, it's just, it's Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld are brilliant, and they would figure
absolutely.
It out.
Yeah, you are listening to the Cold Oatmeal Podcast. It's a production of the team here at Rest Strategies. I'm Matt. I'm joined by Nick and Sarah and Joe. And we talked about this a little bit on our pilot episode, if you happen to listen, but this podcast is a project of ours where we want to talk to interesting people who work in the field and the industries where we work and talk about some of the issues that we come across on a daily basis. And so I came across an article and I wanted to run this past you all because we do quite a bit of work with social media. Emily talked about how social media has changed the work that they do at MEDC and PR. And so this is an article from CNN that I wanted to share. And I guess I wanted to get your initial reaction to the idea of social media camp. Not YMCA camp or basketball camp or band camp. What do you think about
this?
I think it's something that you
social media camp.
Is this for children or for professionals?
Well, let me read a little bit. So here we go. Sleepaway camp may evoke memories of s'mores, log cabins, and bonding with lifelong friends, but one camp in Los Angeles focuses on helping teens become internet stars.
Oh, Lord.
Young adults from all over the world come from as far as Germany and South Africa, traveled to the Hollywood area this summer to take part in Social Star Creator Camp. The camp's 10-day sessions offer instruction in how to monetize Instagram and YouTube accounts and feature talks from marketing instructors, entrepreneurs, and YouTube personalities. Attendees also learn tips on lighting videos, lighting for videos, editing tapes, editing clips, and how to juggle their personal life with their online persona, all for a price tag of about $2,690 for 10 days. So, social media camp.
That is just the dumbest thing I think I've ever heard.
I want to know why you're not sending, is there a Rush Strategies scholarship I can apply for for social media camp?
I think this.
How would this not be useful for us if we have a social media star in-house who's, you know.
Because they're teaching you how to, you know.
Trained and ready to go.
Get millions of people to watch you do dumb things on YouTube.
And it's targeted at teenagers?
Yeah, it's yeah.
If there's one group, if there's one population group in the United States of America that needs less social media, it's teenagers.
120 teenagers attended the social media camp this summer.
I can see some valid good things coming out of this, like editing videos, getting, you know, learning how to make quality videos. I think is really important, especially for people who want to go into this field and do social media. But I think that, you know, making people social media stars and influencers, you can't, that's not something you can train for. I think it's dumb.
It reminds me a little bit of every time you've heard a client or someone say, I want to do a video, I want it to go viral. How can I make this go viral?
Right.
It you can't really predict those things. And this kind of feels like a camp about how do you go make things viral? And it's a hard thing to predict, and I think Sarah's is right about that. All of these things happen naturally. You don't become a star because you went to camp to learn how to be a star, necessarily.
So you're talking about, excuse me, individuals of means. Yeah, I mean, it's an expensive camp.
Yes.
Individuals of means traveling across the country to learn how to better share their silly opinion. Imagine the cocktail in the mix here of hormones and self-importance. I mean, it's
and good lighting.
Yeah, and good lighting. Well, it'll be well lit when somebody films the documentary of this place and the horror show that ensues.
A lot of these kids.
I would watch that documentary though.
No, a lot of these kids from the article are not. I should preface this. A lot of these kids don't appear to be your typical everyday teen. One of these kids was a DJ, has hundreds of thousands of followers. One of these girls was actually an actress and has done TV, and a lot of this was coaching on how to build your online persona, because as they said in the article, and actually this has been reported in a couple places. I'm reading from CNN, but I also read a lengthy article in a political commentary magazine that talked about how TV studios, movie studios, are looking to hire stars, young stars, who bring with them huge audiences of online followers, so that when they pitch the TV show that this person is starring in or appearing in, they have a ready-made audience of 500,000 kids who are going to watch that show because they know this person and has a connection to them online.
I mean, yeah, you have a leg up if you already have 500,000 followers on Instagram. That definitely gives you an advantage.
I mean, I do. I don't have a leg up on anything. I've got 100. I've got.
Right. You have 500,000 followers. No, of course I do. I was like, I manage the Instagram. Like,
my life is just as normal. I have that many. No.
Yeah. $2,000. I think it sounds like a steal. I think you go and you become a star. I'm all for it.
If this world needs anything else, it's one more Kim Kardashian.
Well, Kim Kardashian didn't have to go to camp to do that.
So no, true. But she should have. Maybe she should have gone to camp or another kind of camp. Okay. Well, we'll start a collection for next year's scholarship so we can send Joe off to Los Angeles for social media camp. He can report back live. Maybe he can do a remote future episode.
Yeah, can send me anywhere for 10 days. I'll go anywhere you want me to go for 10 days. Social media camp can be at the top of the list.
Done. Okay. Thanks for joining us today on Cold Oatmeal. Thank you for Emily Garant for joining us, and we will talk to you again next time.
Keep my head on straight, though I wouldn't hesitate. All those problems.